Hello, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You are currently listening to a special broadcast of a panel hosted by the Center for Feminist Legal Studies at Howard Law School. This panel is entitled Feminism, Ableism, and Medical Assistance in Dying. Please be aware that this panel contains discussion of suicide.
Well, my name is Margot Young. I'm a professor at Allard School of Law, and I'm currently director of the Center for Feminist Legal Studies, which is the organizational host of this session, and it's wonderful to have all of you here, both with us in person and through the marvel miracle of Zoom. I want to begin by acknowledging that we're on the Coast Salish traditional unceded lands, and in particular, the lands of the Musqueam. UBC is a site of traditional learning, connection to the land for the Musqueam, and so it's appropriate as well that we both acknowledge our gratitude in for many of us being here as uninvited guests, and also deeply appreciate the significance of the learning that we're going to do today about important issues of equity that we, with gratitude, hold on these lands of the Musqueam. The talk today that you've all either zoomed in or walked into is entitled Feminism, Ableism, and Medical Assistance in Dying. And we're going to hear from Professors Janine Benedict, Catherine Frazee, Isabel Grant, and Elizabeth Sheehy. Unfortunately, Professor Sheehy can't be with us in person, but Janine, who is with us in person, Professor Benedict will be sharing some comments from Professor Sheehy. I want to begin just by noting a content warning for this talk, that this talk will include discussion of suicide, eugenics, and male violence against women. There will be flashing intermittently on the screen a slide that gives you contact numbers if you need to reach out for assistance at this moment during this talk or after it because of the content of the talk. So now, it's my real pleasure and honor to introduce our speakers. Isabel Grant, who is Professor of Law at the University of British Columbia, will be speaking first and then having another appearance a bit later on in our order. Janine Benedict, who is also Professor of Law at the University of British Columbia, will follow, speaking both from her own perspective and expertise, but also with prepared remarks who, because she couldn't be here, has given the written text. Prepared remarks from Elizabeth Sheehy, who is Professor Emerita at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law. We will also then hear from Catherine Frazee, who is Professor Emerita in the School of Disability Studies at Toronto Metropolitan University and also former Chief Commissioner of the Ontario Human Rights Commission. We have a prepared video from Professor Frazee. I'm going to end before turning the floor over to Isabel just by saying what a real honor it is and how lucky we are to have these four experts come to us from across the country to speak to an issue that is of great significance and concern in our country at the moment. And this really is an important occasion, and I'm absolutely thrilled and, as I said many times, honored to have the Center for Feminist Legal Studies be able to host this event.
Thanks very much, Margot. And I'd just like to start by thanking Margot for thinking about doing this issue and giving us an opportunity to talk to you about why the rapid expansion of medical assistance in dying should be of concern to feminists. I'm going to start with just a brief introduction, and then we'll each pass it off to each other as we move through it, ending with Catherine Frazee, who will talk about why there has been such an absence of an intersectional feminist analysis of MAID, and with a call for solidarity between feminists and those in the disability community. Very simply, we see the expanded version of MAID as a form of eugenics against people with disabilities. How we do that is we portray death as a form of medical treatment, but only for disabled Canadians. And in doing so, we endanger and devalue the lives of people with disabilities. We'll talk today about how women are disproportionately impacted by chronic illness, poverty, male violence, social isolation, and medical ableism. And this is particularly true for older women and racialized and Indigenous women. So just to give you a brief introduction, what is MAID, medical assistance in dying? Canada has legalized both medically assisted suicide, which is when a doctor provides a fatal combination of drugs which the patient consumes themselves, and euthanasia, when a doctor or nurse practitioner injects that fatal cocktail into an individual. These are legislated in our criminal code as exemptions to the crimes of aiding suicide and murder, respectively. In Canada, roughly 98% of all MAID deaths are euthanasia. In 2021, for example, California, which doesn't allow euthanasia, had roughly 400 assisted suicides. Canada, with roughly the same population as California, had over 10,000 MAID deaths. So who can access MAID? There are two tracks to accessing MAID in Canada. Track one was enacted in 2016 after the Supreme Court of Canada decision in Carter. It deals with people whose natural death is reasonably foreseeable. This doesn't mean that someone has to be dying. It just means that their death has to be foreseeable from the condition in question. Track two, which was enacted in 2021, involves people whose death is not foreseeable. So people with conditions like chronic pain, MS, multiple chemical sensitivities, and fibromyalgia. Track two, unlike track one, is supposed to have a 90-day waiting period. Now, these may sound like two separate groups of people, but in fact, there's a great deal of overlap between the two of them. What we're seeing in Canada is people who start out as people whose deaths are not foreseeable under track two. But then if they reduce their food intake or stop eating altogether, they can quickly be shifted to track one, thus undermining the waiting period altogether. This makes it especially troubling that Canada has no system in place for monitoring whether safeguards are being applied and no system in place to review cases after the fact. Now, we're going to focus on track two MAID today for a couple of reasons. The first is that the Supreme Court of Canada made some form of track one MAID inevitable after its decision in Carter. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, we think track two is the clearest example of the ableist and eugenic beliefs that are underlying this policy. But we don't want you to think that that's an endorsement of how track one is operating in Canada. Rather, we're using track two to illustrate our points. And I want to say one more quick thing about language. I do use the acronym MAID simply because it's convenient. And this acronym may make some sense for people who are actually dying. What we're doing is easing them into a less painful death. But it makes no sense and is completely dishonest when we are talking about track two. We are not easing people into a less painful death. This is not end-of-life care. This is doctors actively killing someone not close to death through a lethal injection. And I know that's blunt language, but that's exactly what it is. Now, who qualifies for track two? Very simply, there are detailed criteria in the code. The person has to have a serious and incurable illness, disease, or disability. They have to have an advanced state of irreversible decline in capability, and they must have physical or psychological suffering that is intolerable to them and that can't be alleviated in a way that is acceptable to them. Right now, Canada limits this to adults and to people who are capable of giving consent, but the government is moving forward to remove even those safeguards. So how is this justified? How can the state be involved in providing death to people who are not dying? And very simply, I think most commonly we see three different justifications. The first is a reliance on the principle of autonomy. People with disabilities should have choice. They shouldn't be forced to live if they don't want to. But if it's really about autonomy, why do we only care about disabled autonomy in this context? And why are we giving doctors and nurse practitioners the gatekeeping role for deciding who lives and who dies? And if it is it about autonomy when some people have no good choices? Their choices are to continue with suffering or to die. Others argue that MAID is in fact about alleviating suffering. How could we expect someone to endure unbearable suffering? Isn't that cruel? But if it's about intolerable suffering, disabled people do not have a monopoly on intolerable suffering. Why is it that we are only offering death to that group? And perhaps more importantly, why is it that there is no state obligation to attempt to alleviate suffering? This is precisely why we have seen cases of people accessing MAID because they cannot afford housing or because they don't want to live in the miserable conditions of long-term care in this country or because they can't get help to stay in their homes. You'll see proponents of MAID tell you that you can't get MAID for poverty, but this assertion is completely false. It ignores the reality that you can't separate suffering that is caused by disability from all the accompaniments of disability, like poverty and social isolation and marginalization. Third, our courts have actually gone so far as to say that we have to allow MAID because it will reduce suicide. The argument here is essentially that if you give people the security blanket of knowing they can access MAID in the future, they will decide not to kill themselves, and you will in fact see a reduction in suicide. Increasingly, we are seeing research that demonstrates that this is false, that MAID does not reduce suicide. And most notably for our conversation today, female suicides actually increase after assisted suicide is legalized. So what is MAID about then? It's not about autonomy. It's not about just alleviating suffering, or we would let anybody access it. And it's not about reducing suicide. It's about disability and about, I think, people's fear of disability. It's premised on the ableist belief that death can be better than life for someone with a disability. And how do we do this? We do it by framing it as a form of medical treatment. If you call it medical treatment, you can construct it as a benefit for people who are accessing it. We're doing something that helps people with disability, not something that harms them. Whereas if you characterize it as suicide, we can see more clearly, I think, that fundamentally we are denying disabled Canadians the same protection of the criminal law that everyone else enjoys. There is no other group for whom death is portrayed as a benefit. No other treatment in the history of medicine whose sole purpose is to kill the patient. Dr. Scott Kim, a psychiatrist and an expert on suicide, wrote in the Globe and Mail a couple of weeks ago that whatever you think of MAID, calling it medical treatment is an especially cruel form of gaslighting for people with disabilities. Now, before turning it over to Professor Benedette, I just want to read a short quote that sums up, I think, really clearly the position we are putting forth today. And it's from a disabled writer and policy analyst and co-founder of the Disability Filibuster, Gabrielle Peters. She says that in many ways, it comes down to whether you believe in the infallibility and the absolute integrity of the institutions of our society or not. If you don't, then at a minimum, you draw the line at the state delivering lethal injections to people who are not near the end of life. Thank you.
Whoa, hold on. Where are you taking all those cacti?
I need to put them near the radio.
How come?
They love to hear Everly's nature-based music on Dead Succulent Haunt every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
Oh, Dead Succulent Haunt? Where your plants can grow and you can mourn those you've lost?
Come on, plants, let's grow.
Megamall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City.
Oh, I see the love thickening over time.
Hello, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You are currently listening to a special broadcast of a panel hosted by the Center for Feminist Legal Studies at Howard Law School. This panel is entitled Feminism, Ableism, and Medical Assistance in Dying. Please be aware that this panel contains discussion of suicide.
Thank you, Isabel. I'm going to turn the mic over to Janine Benedict now.
I'd just start by saying thank you so much to the Center for Feminist Legal Studies for hosting this really important discussion. I'm honored to be a part of it with these amazing feminists and to offer some brief observations. But before I do that, I actually just want to acknowledge that today I'm thinking about our late colleague, Judy Mossoff, who passed away a number of years ago and who did so much work in the field of disability. And I'm thinking about a conversation I had with Judy when some of these constitutional cases were working their way through the system, and I was directing the CFLS at that time. And I asked Judy whether we ought to do, you know, a kind of panel discussion, or she might want to talk on the expansion of medical assistance in dying for people and the sort of a critical disability analysis of that. And she said no, and she said it's because, you know, we only ever want to talk about disabled people when we're talking about killing them, which is sort of a typical Judy kind of line. But I do think it's a point worth keeping in mind. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm happy for the interest in this topic. I'm just sort of awed by the intellect and analysis of my feminist colleagues on this topic. But I also think it's really important for us to make space for conversations about disability that are not about suffering and death, and that are in fact about pride and joy and about all of the other aspects of the lives of people with disabilities that deserve discussion and reflection and attention. But I want to say something today about why, as feminists, we ought to oppose the idea of assisting people with disabilities whose deaths are not imminent to commit suicide. And there are lots of, you know, important statistics that we can look at about the ways in which the structure of doctor-assisted suicide can disproportionately affect women, and in particular, Indigenous women, poor women, and so on. And I agree with that analysis, and I think it's compelling. But I want to say that at the level of principle, there is a feminist analysis that goes beyond numbers, and that still applies regardless of how many women with disabilities are being killed as opposed to how many men. In other words, if those numbers were equal, I would still see that there is a feminist analysis here. And I'm going to explain that in two ways. And the first is to remind us, and Professor Grant has already alluded to this in her mention of autonomy, is that, of course, there is a feminist critique of relying on choice as the only thing that matters when we decide whether we ought to permit a particular kind of practice that can cause harm. And I think that's really important because the defenders of the current expansion of assisted suicide really rest their analysis on individual choice. Individual choice is a compelling framework for those wedded to an individual liberal analysis in which we're all agents making decisions about our lives, especially when that choice can be framed as personal and not harming anyone else. But of course, feminists have developed a compelling critique of choice. First, because women's choices are shaped by patriarchy and male supremacy. Systemic sexism conditions women from birth to see the world in certain ways and to understand ourselves in certain ways, to value a certain conception of beauty, to judge ourselves on our sexual desirability to men, to take responsibility for caring for others without complaint or compensation, and to put ourselves second to apologize for taking up space. Now, I know that in every one of those domains that I have mentioned, there is resistance and complication, mostly because of feminist consciousness raising. But we have to at least recognize, as a central component of feminist analysis, that as we make choices, we are swimming upstream against those social constructs the entire time. And so for the defenders of doctor-assisted suicide, those powerful social constructs barely seem to register. Instead, what I hear people say is it doesn't have to be either or. We can have good social supports and wide open access to medical assistance in dying. But of course, eugenics, I mean, if we look to our history, has always used efficiency as a powerful, if unstated, justification for why we are better off getting rid of certain kinds of people, right? And so the idea that both of these things can just coexist, I think, is completely blind to that history. And more fundamentally, I think that these people who are wedded to this choice argument fail to see that their conception of medical assistance in dying as a social good, as something merciful and desirable, is shaped by the lack of availability of a world in which people with disabilities can thrive. And so in a world that sees some people as less than, as less worthy than the availability, the very availability of this kind of track to medical assistance in dying obstructs the creation of that very world. So the idea that you can just say, well, we can have both, I think is naive. And of course, the second related point is that even as sexism constructs how we see ourselves and the world in which we live, male power further limits our choices through more direct acts of coercion that affect our ability to choose. And I'll link back to this in a minute when I offer you some of Professor Sheehy's remarks, but in terms of women who are subject to male violence. But just generally, I would say that accepting that women choose things that cause us harm and not questioning those choices, and in fact, in this case, even going so far as to celebrate them, is easy, because our acceptance of women's masochism and our kind of self-abnegation runs very, very deep. And this analysis can apply in other contexts as well, right? Women choosing polygamy, women remaining with an abusive husband, women choosing to be commercial surrogates. And I think it's got clear application to physician-assisted suicide. We can believe that women would choose death rather than live in bodies that are not considered hot by mainstream society. We can believe that women would choose death rather than demanding quality care after giving a lifetime of caring for others. They want it. They asked for it. And somehow we can accept that without question. And of course, notions of choice for women with disabilities are constructed within the interlocking boxes of sexism and ableism, and Professor Frazee will talk more about that in a minute. But put another way, who suffers, and when we consider that suffering irremediable, are metrics that are socially constructed in ways that are shaped by sex and disability, among other identities. And so I would just say that as feminists, we should never accept that simple appeals to individual choice are enough to justify any practice, let alone a practice that results in dead women and dead girls soon, if the government has its way. And I think as feminists, we should also be able to see power, right? Who has it and who does not? And not confuse a thin notion of agency as the same thing. Power is the ability not only to choose for yourself, but to direct the choices of others. And a feminist analysis would remind us that power goes hand in hand with privilege. And in the context of doctor-administered suicide, it's doctors who have the power to suggest, to recommend, to encourage a certain course of treatment, and ultimately to inject the lethal drugs that are going to kill someone. And so when death, whether suicide or homicide, is repackaged as treatment, that power becomes very dangerous. Right, all of the power that produces bad outcomes in healthcare, cost pressures and time pressures are still there. The power, the really intoxicating power of, you know, holding life and death in your hands and to decide whose life is worth living, And one would think that if we were going to give people that power, we would want an enormous degree of accountability and oversight. And we would see it as a huge red flag when that oversight is dismantled and relabeled as, you know, when safeguards are relabeled as barriers. And I think that I am influenced here by, you know, I spent quite a bit of time, did my graduate work in the state of Michigan. And this was at a time when Jack Kevorkian, is a name that many of our students might not recognize, but was very active in Michigan. And he was a doctor that really pushed the limits on physician-assisted suicide, really campaigned for it, and carried out a number of so-called physician-assisted suicides in Michigan, despite the fact that there was no law that would have permitted him to do that. And juries were consistently acquitting him, and he had sort of become this folk hero who was bringing all of this mercy to these suffering people. Turned out that really only about 25% of the people whom he killed actually had a terminal diagnosis. 71% of them were women. And he moved pretty quickly from setting up machines in which the individual would kill themselves to just doing it himself directly. And he was ultimately convicted of second degree murder. And I think about what happens in a regime in which that oversight is now somehow seen as a discriminatory barrier. And then I'll just say that a second key site of feminist analysis beyond the critique of choice is the critique of privacy, right? The idea that women should be confined to the private sphere, specifically the home, and that what goes on in the private sphere should be outside the reach of the law. And feminists have pointed out the way this analysis places women at tremendous risk and has left many of the most important issues for women untouched by the state. And again, I think that classic feminist critique of privacy has some real resonance in the area of physician-assisted suicide, in part because we removed almost every safeguard we have to protect vulnerable people. And at the same time, the Minister of Justice is tweeting out support for the right to suicide. There's a tremendous push for secrecy around these deaths before they happen in the name of patient privacy. And so we now have reports of family members who find out only after their loved one is dead that their relative has been planning with a doctor to kill themselves with no consultation with family members who love this person and may have no idea how much they are struggling. And I think feminists know to be suspicious of secrets, especially when the result of those secrets is the death of women. Abuses of power thrive in secrecy, and feminists know that and have been saying that in other contexts for many, many years. That's not to say that families are always a positive influencer. There can, in fact, be family pressure, often influenced by ageism. But usually we make an exception to rules around confidentiality when a person is suicidal. But now, when that person has disabilities, somehow that's transformed into a right to privacy, just as we transform suicide into medical treatment. So I think a feminist analysis of medical assistance in dying and doctor-assisted suicide should ask some hard questions. Who gains and who loses when women with disabilities and mental illnesses kill themselves? What is the relationship between systemic sexism and the quality of research, treatment, and care that is provided to women, especially older women, Indigenous women, and poor women? And the question fundamentally, does patriarchy make women suffer? Does it make them mentally ill? And how is male violence disabling for women? That is just some of what I think a feminist analysis of doctor-assisted suicide requires. Now, I just want to take a couple of moments to offer you some remarks from Professor Sheehy. She's unfortunately dealing with a family situation today and so can't join us in person. But she did provide some remarks, and particularly given that Professor Sheehy is one of Canada's foremost experts on violence against women, I want to just take a couple of minutes to tell you some of the things she would have said if she were here. And in particular, in her comments, she was hoping to share with you She's identified four of the structures that bear on the lives of women with disabilities. And the first of those is women's poverty. It's important to recognize that women are more likely than men to both experience disability, and that women are more likely to live longer than men, and rates of disability, of course, increase with age. And we know that a growing number of Track 2 made requests, in fact, stem from the social, health, and economic conditions in which people with non-terminal disabilities are forced to live. We know that women are overrepresented amongst low-income families and individuals in Canada, more likely to experience food insecurity, to live on low income. And it's entirely predictable that we will find that women with disabilities who are poor will be offered medical assistance in dying or driven to it in disproportionate numbers because they cannot find stable, safe housing, appropriate treatment, or other forms of social and community support. So poverty is one. The second she identifies is the medical profession, because of course it's doctors who are vested with the responsibility to determine whether MAID is authorized for a patient. And of course, we know that the medical profession has a history of and current practices of both ableism and sexism. There was a study last year in the United States of physician attitudes and reporting that doctors find patients with disabilities burdensome to their practices and assert that the remuneration they receive for care is inadequate. And they describe important structural barriers to providing appropriate care, like strict time limits on appointments and lack of accommodation. Other doctors surveyed displayed attitudes of resentment towards their patients with disabilities or refused them care if their needs were seen as too complex. We know that women patients have been disadvantaged by the medical community. Women's symptoms of illness might not be recognized because they differ from men's. Women are disbelieved regarding their symptoms and their experiences of pain, and their physical unwellness is often attributed to psychiatric conditions or left undiagnosed and untreated. And so we might worry that women with undiagnosed, untreated, or under-medicated conditions might seek medical assistance in dying, and that doctors might be more likely to assess women with disabilities as qualifying. The third factor that she identifies here is women's socialization, also known as patriarchy. And so some of that is very simple, that women with disabilities are more likely to be isolated and living with fewer supports. Dawn, the Disabled Women's Network, reported that male partners of women with disabilities were about 2.5 times more likely to behave in a patriarchal dominating manner, and about 1.5 times more likely to engage in a sexually proprietary behavior. And of course, there's also the issue that women's socialization as caregivers rather than as receivers of care, something I mentioned as well, may make them more anxious about being a burden to others. And so that's important as well in another area that's extremely under-researched, because most of the research in this area is gender neutral, leaving the woman question unexplored. But perceived burdensomeness is important, right? And an important factor that drives some people to seek medical assistance in dying when this is supposed to be a process that is free from external pressures. And then I'll just end by mentioning men's violence against women, which of course is a cause of women's disablement. And we're only just beginning to uncover, for example, the extent of the traumatic brain injuries experienced by women as a result of male violence. We know that women with disabilities are at an even higher risk of intimate partner assault and sexual assault. And a recent report in the United Kingdom found that women who experience intimate partner abuse are 3 times more likely to attempt suicide, and that rate raises to 7 times more likely if men use sexual violence as well. And so given how seldom women actually disclose these forms of male violence, how will we know if women's requests for medical assistance in dying for irremediable suffering are not fueled by men's violence against women? male abusers can be very effective at manipulating persons in authority. And so again, that speaks to this impetus to transform safeguards into barriers and to simply remove them. And maybe I'll just end by saying that, you know, one of the common tactics for abusive men to show how thoroughly the woman is in their control is to give her a gun and dare her to shoot him before he kills her. And Professor Sheehy, in her book, Defending Battered Women on Trial, has written extensively about this topic. And when she doesn't go through with it, it's a way of saying that his life is more important and he's in control of who lives and who dies in the relationship. We also see quite common for abusive men to tell women that they should kill themselves because they are a waste of space. And track two, medical assistance in dying, doesn't seem to have any awareness of these realities, of what's really happening in the lives of women who are in violent relationships, who were subject to coercive control from their abusive male partners, and to even take into account the ways in which that might condition and affect the requests for medical assistance in dying.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Hello, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You are currently listening to a special broadcast of a panel hosted by the Center for Feminist Legal Studies at Howard Law School. This panel is entitled Feminism, Ableism, and Medical Assistance in Dying. Please be aware that this panel contains discussion of suicide.
I just want to talk really briefly about Made for Mental Illness. You know, there's been a lot of attention in the media about that, and I think it's important that we at least have a discussion about it. First, I want to make two very basic preliminary points. We would not be talking to you about Made for Mental Illness if it weren't for Track 2 Made. People do not die from mental illnesses other than through suicide. So Track 2 Made has enabled this conversation. The other point, equally basic, people with mental illness are already getting made. Many people with mental illness have coexisting physical disabilities. People with mental illness are not excluded from Track 1 or Track 2 Made. They are only excluded from Made entirely based on their mental illness. Now, there are very few places in the world that allow this, but what we've learned from the countries that do is that psychiatric MAID overwhelmingly and kills women. 70 to 77% of all psychiatric MAID deaths are women. And in one study, they found 36% of those had a history of severe sexual or other abuse. So that's a really alarming statistic, and especially in light of what Janine was saying. The other thing about psychiatric MAID to think about is that diagnoses in psychiatry are themselves gendered. Depression, for example, is the leading reason for psychiatric MAID. Women are more than twice as likely to be given a diagnosis of depression. Other conditions are deeply gendered as well. PTSD, borderline personality disorder, anorexia, all of these have led to psychiatric MAID deaths in the Netherlands and Belgium. And one thing I find really interesting is that there's an age pattern for women who access this that doesn't apply to men. Women who access psychiatric MAID are likely to be in their 40s or 50s. And I think it's really interesting to think about that through a feminist lens. When we live in a society that profoundly devalues aging women. Now, I think the two issues around psychiatric MAID that have gotten the most attention are the question of irremediability, and that's this notion that MAID requires that the condition for which you access MAID is irremediable. And psychiatrists have told us they can't do this. They cannot tell us who will get better and who will not. And that is an uncontested fact in the literature. The second issue that has drawn the most attention is if we allow MAID solely for the basis of people who are experiencing mental illness, what does that say about suicide prevention in this country? What does it say in Indigenous communities that have serious problems with the suicide crisis, serious problems with violence against Indigenous women? You see how all these factors kind of play together and set up a deadly, vicious cycle. And this is why Indigenous witnesses at Parliament spoke out against expanding MAID. They talked about how their communities had seen too much death and how MAID is contrary to Indigenous understandings of death. So just really briefly, I want to speak a little bit about what's called the gender paradox in suicide. So many of you may know that men are actually much more likely to commit suicide than women. But the paradox is that many more women attempt suicide. And the way that's explained is that men who kill themselves choose more violent means. So when they attempt suicide, they are more likely to succeed. A recent study has shown that the numbers for psychiatric MAID map almost perfectly onto the numbers of attempted suicide for women. So what this means is effectively we are giving women a way to ensure that their attempted suicides become completed suicides. We're making it easier for them to kill themselves by providing a method that's described as nonviolent and peaceful and all the other descriptors that are given by proponents of MAID. But the difference is that MAID is 100% effective and 100% fatal. The last thing I'm going to say before turning it over to Catherine is we don't have time today to talk about something that deeply worries me, and that is the implications of Track 2 MAID, and especially MAID for mental illness in Canadian prisons. We're offering people who don't have a choice to leave the intolerable conditions in which we are placing them, but we're giving them a choice to die. And I see this as a human rights catastrophe in the making. And on that note, I'm going to turn it over to my friend, Catherine Frizzy.
In the NFB documentary titled The Examined Life, there is a magical 15-minute segment that captures a meandering conversation between feminist philosopher Judith Butler and disabled artist activist Sonora Taylor. In keeping with the film's byline, Philosophy is in the Streets, Butler and Taylor stroll the sidewalks in San Francisco's Bay Area and talk as they walk. They talk about walking, what counts as walking and the infrastructure that supports it. They talk about social spaces, who they are for and what makes them welcoming. They talk about bodies and body parts and the uses that we make of them. They dig into a vintage clothing store and do a bit of shopping, just like you would if you were hanging out with Judith Butler on a sunny afternoon in town. It's all quite delicious. Toward the end of the segment, Butler sums up what she has heard. Now I'm paraphrasing here only slightly. The way I see it, what's at stake here is rethinking the human as a site of interdependency. When you walk into the coffee shop, when you ask for coffee and for some assistance with the coffee, you're basically posing the question, do we or do we not live in a world in which we help each other with basic needs? and our basic needs there to be decided on as a social issue and not just your personal issue. There's a challenge, she says, to individualism that happens at the moment in which you ask for some assistance with the coffee, and hopefully people will take it up and say, yes, I too live in that world in which I understand that we need each other in order to address our basic needs. And I want to organize a social political world on the basis of that recognition. And that, for me, is a wonderfully evocative reflection. I offer it today as we begin this panel, in part for its framing of the questions of world building with which MAID expansion confronts us. And I also offer this vignette because of a rather idiosyncratic question that the Butler-Taylor conversation evokes for me. Feminists and disability activists used to walk together so generously and productively. What happened? In the span of just a few years, MAID has expanded well beyond its original formulation. By my observation, that expansion has unfolded, persisted, and been quietly condoned in the absence of a robust, intersectional feminist critique. And that's what brings me here to this panel. That's what has me waxing all nostalgic about Judith Butler's amiable walk with Sonora Taylor in 2008. I want to know where productive conversations between feminist sisters went off the rails and how we can get back to them. All I have are intuitions, but intuitions have always been a good starting point for the feminist project of stretching consciousness. So let me start from the proposition that both the women's movement and the disability movement have at times drifted from our core mission of refusing domination. The struggles that convulsed but ultimately strengthened feminism's second wave, struggles between reformist and revolutionary thinkers, they're well documented in our history. Reformist feminists wanted maximized freedom within the existing system, whereas revolutionary feminists were seeking a deeper, more expansive liberation that would bring patriarchy to its knees. While reform feminists had some early successes, their victories did not reach those who bore the fullest brunt of patriarchal power. As bell hooks observed, reformist efforts too often ran counter to the interests of poor, working class, and racialized women. Patriarchy, it turned out, was willing to make concessions to certain women in order to preserve white supremacy and keep out the hordes at its gate. I think we can apply a similar critique to the early politics of disability liberation. Within a bubble of white, well-educated high achievers, we leaned too heavily toward a reformist agenda. The movement made very few enemies, which is rarely an indicator of deep social progress. The consciousness we raised was the consciousness of assimilation and personal entitlement, decidedly not the consciousness of solidarity. It was a consciousness that ultimately expressed itself in the rights claims of Sue Rodriguez, Floria Taylor, and Nicole Gladue, the consciousness of unfettered, privileged autonomy. Those of us who played leading roles in that era must now reckon with the fact that our reformist successes served only those of us who had sufficiently stable health and material security to enrich our lives with more education, better jobs, and more enviable leisure activity. We had prioritized our desires over the far more urgent needs of our poor, racialized, indigenous, and gender non-conforming comrades, as well as those whose conditions of chronic pain or illness, speech or cognitive impairment required far more than prying open a few choice doors into the fortress where ableism rules. My point here is not to disparage early efforts in disability rights work to achieve equal access and accommodation. But as we shaped cultural norms about the kinds of bodies that occupy public space, our arrival implied that those bodies would be all white, cisgendered, and middle class. We forgot that access is a means, not an end in itself. The core question must always be access to what and for whom? Access is worth fighting for insofar as it advances a plurality of disabled citizens toward equality, not toward assimilation in ableist regimes. One has only to listen to the discourse that gave rise to May's expansion and now righteously defends it, observing the frequency with which access is cited as an imperative for MAID, to understand where an uncritical fidelity to access can go terribly wrong in the hands of reformist advocates. To get our movement conversations back on track, we must be very clear about our goals. Just as feminism is fundamentally a challenge to patriarchy, the project for disability rights is to expose, resist, and ultimately uproot ableism. Ableism is far more than the prejudicial views and discriminatory practices affecting disabled people. Ableism is a pervasive ideology that underlies, perpetuates, and maintains prejudice and discrimination. Fiona Kamari Campbell said this most plainly. Ableism is not about disability. It is about perfection. Ableism shapes the norms, ideals, and values that govern all of our relations. Our notions of personhood and citizenship, of necessity and priority, of waste and worth, deviance and deficiency, of what is ordinary and what is extraordinary. All of the infrastructure, rhetoric, and rituals of our civil and political life are built upon the bedrock of ableism. Ableism is our very particular manifestation of patriarchy. And as with patriarchy, its punishments are unevenly distributed among us. Ableism is on full display in Canada's MAID laws. The foundational logic for Track 2, that the suffering of disabled people warrants a special easing of eligibility thresholds for MAID, builds from an ableist premise that disability suffering is inexorable, categorically distinct from the suffering of any non-disabled person, and remediable only by extreme medical intervention. Simultaneously, an ableist account of autonomy justifies the practice of offering a choice between suffering and death, that is, between what is bad and what is worse, while denying the means to an array of good choices available to others. Ableism infects the law's definition of irremediable. Suffering from isolation, demoralization, social and material deprivation, food and housing insecurity, the feeling of being a burden, unpack every one of these recurring themes in the Track 2 victim profile, and you will find that all are actually preventable. Yet the law effectively requires physicians to concede that what is on offer by way of state-funded care and support is as immutable as impairment itself, and that suffering that arises between the cracks of available care is lawfully madeable. Supports that would prevent or relieve suffering, but are not made available, factor nowhere in the determination of Track 2 eligibility, nor in our monitoring of the practice over time. This effectively depoliticizes disability suffering, stripping away the layers of race, class, sex, indigeneity, and gender conformity that are crucial to an equality analysis. It also surely invites an intersectional feminist interrogation of the forces that mobilize suffering and the legal and political levers that must be pulled to arrest them. And let's not forget that made law is infused with accounts of dignity that both amplify and entrench ableist discourse about what bodily states and styles of function are and are not dignified, and what forms of dependency so offend the fiction of radical self-sufficiency as to constitute madeable indignity. This too is fertile ground for feminist inquiry. To walk in solidarity with disability rights defenders on the issue of medically hastened death, most of us will have to accept some limits on our privileged autonomy. Many of us will have to abandon the hubris of full control in life. Those whom Paul Longmore once described as severely able-bodied will no doubt need to summon a little more courage to bear their share of life's natural losses. And many of us will have to step back so that others can lead. None of this will be easy, but easy isn't a word that comes readily to mind for the diehard feminist, is it? Thank you.